Kia ora and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. My name's Pip Adam and this is episode 133. This is a very, very special episode for me, and there are a million people to thank for making it possible. So today what we've got is a recording of an event that took place at Verb Festival in Wellington a couple of weeks ago. Verb is just the most amazing festival. It just programs these really exciting events, and this year there was just this great sort of kaupapa of curators for different parts of the festival, and yeah, it was just an amazing weekend. It always feels just so, it builds its own little community around itself as it takes place, you know, people from all over New Zealand, and there were a few Australian people visiting, and yeah, it was a really, really beautiful weekend, and just massive thanks to the Verb team. So this is a recording of an event with Jared Davidson, the author of Blood and Dirt, which is just an incredible book about prison labour and how that prison labour kind of has shaped Aotearoa New Zealand, well, New Zealand really. I felt incredibly grateful to be speaking with Jared. I am a massive fan of this book. I don't know Jared well, and this book just blew my mind, and yeah, I just feel incredibly grateful that he sort of trusted me to have this conversation with him. Can't recommend the book highly enough. It's called Blood and Dirt. I'll say it again. So this is the conversation that we had. As always, like, Jared is also an archivist and was incredibly generous in saying, I think we should leave the recording as it is. And I think that's a really, really good idea, because it becomes a bit of a record of that day. The only issue was that we didn't have a roving mic, so my recording did not pick up any of the questions that came from the audience, and there were a lot of questions. I haven't been at an event in ages that had that many questions, so it was really exciting because it really did feel like a conversation rather than sort of like a lecture. What I've done is I've revoiced them, not trying to pretend to be the people, but just sort of summarising the questions or rewording them. So as you go through, you'll hear me ask for questions, and then you'll hear me sort of restating or kind of summarising the question that's asked. I hope that's okay. There may be people listening who were there and whose questions are asked. I hope that's okay. But I hope you enjoy this. You are in for a treat. I've listened to this several times and it just gets better and better. So here is me speaking with Jared Davidson about his amazing book, Blood and Dirt. This is at the Verb Festival 2023. Thank you so much, Verb.
Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa. Nau mai, haere mai ki te Verb 2023, Readers and Writers Week. Jared Davidson, Blood and Dirt. Thank you so much. Ko Pip Adam Aho. Whakamihi mana whenua o te whanganui a Tara, te Atiawa Taranaki whānui ki te upoko o te Ika a Maui. And also just a massive acknowledgement of Verb's Te Tiriti partners, te ha a ngā pō kaituhi Māori. Thank you so much. Also just whakamahi to the whare. Thank you, St. Peter's, for having us here. And also, both Jared and I thought it was important just to kind of bring to mind what is probably already on your mind, which is the atrocities that are taking place in Palestine as we gather today. We talk a lot at these events about the power of words, but I think in the face of the things that are happening, we have very few words. And One thing I just want to acknowledge, that I imagine there are people in the room who are taking time out from their activism to be here today. And I imagine also that there are people who would like to be here but are doing amazing work in the community. So I just want to acknowledge that work and sort of, yeah, maybe not in words but in actions, we have some hope, which is really great. I think there's probably quite a lot of crossover between people who are feeling deeply about Palestine and those who are interested in the topics that are in Jared's amazing book, Blood and Dirt, Prison Labour and the Making of New Zealand. This is a work that I think is just so incredibly important at the moment for lots of reasons. But one of the very stark reasons that I think it's important is that it allows us to be in this place in a slightly different way, in a way that makes visible some of the violences that took place here. So I think some of the violences that took place in the name of the capitalist goals for progress and productivity. So with that in mind, I just wanted to sort of bring into this mihi a small reading from Jared's book. The reason I wanted to do this, and thanks Jared for letting me do it, is that I think it helps us settle into the land that we're on in a way that I think brings to mind the people, the many, many people that worked around here, and also many who died in labour. And also, I think I can speak for Jared as well, it also just brings to mind that there are thousands of incarcerated people very close to where we're meeting today. So I just wanted to bring that to mind. So this is from Jared's book. Back in Wellington, a group of 30 East Coast Māori were sentenced to death for their association with Te Kuti and for levelling war against the Queen. Captured by the government-aligned forces of Rāpata Wahawaha and Te Kipiti Rangihiwi Nui, they were tried on the 27th of June 1870. Their sentence was commuted to imprisonment, and this time to be served in Wellington. From the Mount Cook Jail, the prisoners made roads down Taranaki Street, including a 5-metre cutting into a hillside. They broke, collected and carried metal to surrounding streets, pathways and parade grounds. They collected shell from the sea that was crushed to make the barracks walls. They dug drains and ditches. They laid grass and watered gardens with fire hoses, especially in the summer months. They made a road and footpath to Tory Street. They dug foundations for a smeltering furnace, and they cleaned the wheeled bricks. The site of modern-day Pukeahu, with its museum and war memorials, was made possible thanks to the toil of incarcerated Māori and many other groups who called the prison workscape home. Thank you so much, Jared. Thank you to Verbs funders as well, Creative New Zealand and Wellington City Council, who make conversations like this possible, which is really neat. So yeah, just whakamihi te whare, whakamihi whenua, and whakamihi ngā tangata. Jared, thank you so much for trusting me with this conversation. I really am very grateful. Jared's agreed to, are you still willing to do a small reading for us? That'd be amazing. And I just wonder if you wanted to start by introducing yourself. I've done a lot of talking, and if you wanted to just introduce yourself, however you feel appropriate.
Thank you. Tēnā koe. Kia ora tātou, ngā mihi nui, kia koutou. Thank you so much for coming along. And I just want to echo your acknowledgement. And just to thank everyone for coming and for all the organisers and everyone doing that invisible labour in the background as well. Mm. Hopefully this session's not too dark and heavy, but yeah, there are some pretty sombre topics that we'll cover. So I'm going to read from the epilogue, and it's basically, the premise of it is my son and I, who's here, we went on a research trip to the Central Plateau. So prisoners built all the highways through around Ruapehu. So before prisoners did the highways, there was no way of driving from Auckland to Wellington. So prisoners did that work, and they upkept about 130 kilometres of highways all through the 1920s. And there was a family connection that I realised to Rauremu. So that's where we start off. The trip was short but fruitful. We had climbed under a bridge and visited sites I now know to be prisons. And the family connection to Rauremu made me think more deeply about other places in my life that had benefited from prison labour. A quick survey was startling. The Thorndon precinct where I work is surrounded by roads built by prisoners. Walking to the Thorndon New World means passing the spot where prisoner August Schroeder was shot and killed by a warder in 1870. Eating my lunch in the staff room of the National Library or nearby in Catherine Mansfield Park, I look up at the hillside planted with prison-raised trees. Gazing at Point Hallsville on my daily train commute, planted by prisoners. Holidays in Tūrangi, surrounded by sites of prison labour. My third book, published by a university whose grounds were levelled and sculpted by prisoners. Then there's growing up in Christchurch, the Botanic Gardens, Victoria Square, High Street, Cranmer Square, Oxford Terrace, the Avon River. Sitting in a field with my dad drawing Hamner Forest, drives around Governor's Bay or over Evans Pass to Sumner, swimming at Motukauaitiiti, Corsair Bay and Rāpaki, the bridle path, school visits to Quail Island, band practice in a Littleton garage on reclaimed land, joining a picket line at Officers Point. All these places were built by prisoners. The more I thought about these spaces, the more connections I was able to draw between unfree labour and the places I take for granted. That's a heavy inheritance. Prison labour forms an invisible layer of memory upon the landscape, the residue of practices that adapted to the uniqueness of New Zealand's Pacific and in turn transformed it. Gone were the treadmills and cranks of England, but not the gendered work of the prison gang, whose toil across cities, farmyards, and coral reefs were powered by the domestic work of incarcerated women. It is a heritage that profoundly alters our understanding of the environment and the processes that went into its making. More than just dark tourism venues or the shadows of long empty prisons, the spaces that have benefited from forced labour are everywhere accessible and in most cases frequented every day. Next time you play the New Zealand version of Monopoly, count how many sites are associated with this book. If much of our landscape is an archive of forced work, why isn't the history of prison labour and its carceral spaces more widely known? And why should we care? And I think that's the kind of two reasons that drove the book. Thanks.
Thanks so much for that reading. We could applause. No. It often lifts the energy, which is quite nice. I always think there's this incredible magic that happens with any work, like whether it's building a house or writing a book, where a need is kind of called out, like there's a need in the world for something, and there's a person who like is motivated and sees that need, if you know what I mean. And I'm just wondering what it is that made this the next project for you, like what was urgent about it and perhaps what you were observing and what, I know you're a very humble person, but I just wonder what it was about the work you'd done before that you felt really well situated to write the book.
In my work I try and think about capitalism and state power and thinking about ways of unpacking that kind of myth of New Zealand exceptionalism, that like some of these things that we might look to overseas didn't happen here. So I guess my work has been interested in that. And at the time, it must have been about 2018, and I kind of was finishing up Dead Letters, which was my first World War censorship book. And I was thinking a lot about enclosure. I was learning a lot about the commons and different ways of kind of being and subsisting outside of capitalism. And around the time, I saw a news article and prisoners had just built the first state house at Rumataka prison, and it was kind of being lifted over this fence and dropped down, and it was kind of this, Chris Hipkin was the, you know, education person at the time and was really kind of woohoo. And just that link between the social housing crisis and prison labour and then this big barbed wire fence and enclosure, it all kind of made sense. But the more kind of geeky answer is, I was thinking of doing a different book on vagrancy and thinking about how people who can't or don't work are forced to by the state. And then once I looked into that and realised that all these people were getting put to work, then I started to wonder, you know, that curiosity was like, what work are prisoners doing? And I talk about it in the book, and I think it's from Hollywood movies. I had this conception of like men in stripes just picking away at kind of rocks. And that certainly happened in Mount Eden. But actually, the more I looked into it, the more I realized that work outside of the prison was an important topic. But also just my politics as well. Mm. You know, a lot of my work and my writing, and I think all of us probably, whether we admit that or not, the projects we take on are tied to kind of your thinking at the time, the other things you're reading. So I was learning a lot more about environmental movements and thinking about class beyond the kind of industrial worker and thinking about the work that reproductive labour, mm-hmm. work that women do. So it all kind of came together at the right time. And then seeing that article, I was like, okay, yeah, there's something here.
Because I think that is one of the things that I find so interesting in the book is that kind of official story, and then, you know, the, I don't want to, like, I always exaggerate, but like that thing of kind of like the story we tell each other about something, but then the truth of it underneath. And I guess I'm quite interested in the place of archives in that, you know, what we choose to keep in the society memory, like in the collective memory, and what we choose. And I wonder, I imagine in this book, I could be wrong, but I imagine that, well, actually you write about it, there's a little bit of looking for the gap, say, like it's not so much, yeah.
Yeah, if we think about, you know, typically archives and whose papers survive and, you know, who's kind of put up on a pedestal, there's been a period of collecting that is very particular to some voices and silences others. Mm. And with prisoners and prison labourers, especially in the, you know, the 19th century, they weren't the type of people to keep diaries or donate their letters to the Turnbull. But in saying that, we do hold some prisoners' letters. But the flip side is they're some of the most surveilled and measured and monitored people out there. And so the flip side of that is there are rich resources in the state archives, Archives New Zealand, but it's not necessarily the voices of those people doing the work. So that was quite hard to kind of tease some of those voices out, because of my practice, I'm really driven by this idea of history from below and being able to kind of allow the voices and the agency of people who are often overlooked. Mm. So that was a difficult thing, researching the book and then kind of reading against the grain and thinking, okay, if there's a gap here, what's happening over here? So one example is there's lots of published state reports by the jailers of each prison, and in 1884 there was a riot on the prison hulk down in Dunedin. So they had a prison hulk ship. They were basically, to relieve overcrowding, they put prisoners on the ship and they'd park them up all along Otago Harbour. And so both roads of Otago Harbour were made by prisoners that way. And one of the government reports is like, there was a small altercation, but it was resolved. And then it had an initial of like 17 men had all been punished. And so, okay, something's going on here, and that's where you can go to the archives and tease out that actually they struck, they refused work, and it led to kind of the Hulk being disestablished while they were building the Aramoana Mole. So yeah, little things like that. So thankful that there are state archives, but obviously there are massive silences.
And I think, you know, this is something that I find so interesting about the book, the contents of the book. And I don't think I prepped you for this question, so you can just go, no. But the proximity, like the necessary proximity to freedom that the labour needed to take place in, if you know what I mean. Like there were literally people, you know, walking down the street to go to work and stuff like that. And this idea of, like, wanting the people to do the work, but also never wanting the people to say organise or, you know, get together. But I just wonder if you could just talk a little bit about how close prisoners and, because I think it's something we've lost now, you know, like I feel like we have a more segregated system now.
Yeah, that question from the epilogue was like, why didn't I know about this history, or why you know, wasn't more known. And I think it's part of that move of putting prisoners out of sight behind forestry and out, you know, Papadua prison, out off a highway, you know, same with the Central Plateau. I think that feeds into it. But in the 19th century, those in power wanted people to see what would happen to them if they played up, if they were idle, you know. So idleness is this really interesting theme that plays through. So, you know, up until 1915, prisoners, you know, on the streets just outside here, they'd march down from the terrace jail to Pukeahu Mount Cook to make the bricks, but also they were building the roads, and it was really visible. They were wearing big, bright red shirts. So it was like this kind of Victorian morality play where it was on display as a kind of like play up and you'll join these folk. But the flip side was labour at the time was so porous that you'd have someone on a chain gang get released from jail and then the next day they're doing the same work for an employer. And so that's one of the arguments about the book, is that we can't separate out free labour or paid work, or however you want to define it, from this kind of coerced, forced labour. Because the overwhelming charge in the 19th century was drunkenness and vagrancy and just not having support networks for people, you know? And that was really surprising to me. So yeah, that's a key argument, is that free and unfree labour don't kind of exist in separate worlds.
Yeah, because one of the most powerful parts of the book is, and like, I know there's more about it, but is that paragraph where it talks about all labour being coercive labour. And I think that, yeah, like I think I hadn't ever thought about it like that, and I found it incredibly useful. And I wonder, just to extend that a little bit, what it is about a study of prison labour that because I know you've studied this in other places, what a study of prison labour can tell us about all other labour, I wonder.
Yeah. I think, and again it goes back to like prisons being put out of sight, out of mind. I kind of had this idea that like bad people went to prison, and I don't know if that's how we're socialised or how I was socialised, but it was like this, I mean, I have the privilege not to have had an engagement with the criminal justice system. And what really surprised me about the book, both the past and the present, is just how incarceration is more than just going on behind the prison fences. Like, it's so tied up with so many structures of power, of just, you know, the environment, work, racism, colonization. It's all entwined, and that was a big learning for me. And I mean, maybe that does speak to the kind of the privilege I have of being able to avoid that, but I hope the book kind of brings that to the fore, and then also gets people to think about the environment a bit more, because that was this started off as being a very straight social history, but I realised that actually, you know, the environment is such a key protagonist in the story as well.
Because that's, I love the way this idea of productivity, like it bleeds into the land. And I know growing up really close we grew up in Ōraki, and, you know, that land, you know, so-called Bastion Point, you know, there was lots of narrative about that land being unproductive. And I just wonder, could you talk a little bit about that? Like, this sort of colonist urge to, you know, make the environment productive as well.
Yeah. One of the big things, and it goes even back to that prison article of the house, I think Hipkins talked about the improvement being made to these people. And then through the research, this word of improvement kept coming up, the idea that like Māori land was wasted, or these places needed improving to make not only like productive and profitable, but so that like the colony would thrive and stuff like that. So improvement became this really big key word. And the original meaning of improvement was to make profit from land, especially from rent. And so that was just like, is this too obvious to write about? But it was just, it became a key framework for the book. And I think we still have it today. And I'd be interested to ask you about this because of your work in prisons, but I think some of the rehabilitative work that's done in prisons is maybe this is getting too heavy, but it's like...
They're still with us.
It's builder's improvement, and that's totally cool, but I don't think we should imprison people so we can improve them. Mm. I'd like to think that we could do that other way, but, I mean, how is writing about prisons and those spaces and alternatives to harm kind of influence? Because Audition, I feel like, is an amazing roadmap to a different kind of care.
Yeah, it is interesting because I know, like, it's really hard because the idea of rehabilitation is really tempting, you know what I mean? Like, it seems... Yeah, and then a lot of criticism we would often get for some of the work we were doing in there is that why should people that have broken the law be allowed to do nice things? You know, why should they be, you know, like, problems in the system outside were often lumped onto, you know, my kid can't get counselling, but there seems to be, you know, like this kind of thing. And I just, yeah, I don't know. I feel it really isn't like that in there. And I think... Yeah, like I know the big thing for me when I was writing the book was looking at alternative forms of justice that are already around, you know, like this idea of social justice and like, you know, like responsibility to a group and drawing people in rather than pushing them away and giving people time and space and yeah, that kind of thing. So, you know, I mean, the book really doesn't, you know, and then of course the massive question about how to be a reasonable visitor in a place that isn't your own, and yeah, like that's the great thing about writing a book, is that I got to read stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like I got to read stuff and increase my knowledge while I was writing the book, which I really really liked. But yeah, and I mean this, yeah, that thing about improvement just rang so true for me, you know, like just, yeah, and improvement to what? That was the other thing, like this very, you know, this very interesting idea of what, like, I don't know what a good person is, I don't know when I'm being good, you know, and yeah, I just find it all so, like, mercury, no, don't touch mercury, kids, but, you know, like, steam in your hands kind of stuff. Yeah, it was just so strange. It was so strange. That was, like, and I guess, like, it's interesting, like, I went that way, you went this way, but I think we're both interested in the same things. And one of the things about the book, and I think you partially answered this in the idea of trying to speak from people's voices rather than sort of above. The book is incredibly, I never know what the right word is, but it's a compelling read, you know, and I feel like because it has the rigor of research and it has facts and it has all those things, like it doesn't necessarily also have to be entertaining. Well, not entertaining is the wrong word, but it doesn't have to be compelling or interesting. And I just, that made me think that you must think there's some value over and above it being a good read to having that kind of narrative structure that where you feel like you really are compelled to read on and you feel emotionally engaged with people. And I just wonder what purpose in a book like this, like in a book that is incredibly well researched, it's based on real life, why do you want to make it also narratively so beautiful?
I am a big believer in narrative nonfiction and trying to trouble the idea of history being boring, and especially thinking about audiences. I'm sure my father won't mind, but my dad's like my target audience, so he'd read, like, I've said this before, but he'll read like a music book, a biography of Dave Grohl, or maybe a local history, or you know, something, or a crime novel. So I feel like if I can hook someone like him with the narrative, and then they'll keep reading, and they'll keep reading, and then they'll start to maybe think, oh, okay, some of these ideas are kind of interesting, and oh, yeah, that theory makes sense. And so, yeah, narrative is really important. So I read a lot, I think a lot about narrative nonfiction writers like Adam Hochschild, David Gran, think a lot about plot, about character. And that's not to say to, you know, make things up, but I do think it is important to structure non-fiction in that way, because it brings people along and makes it accessible, which is really important. And that second part of your question, you know, and actually I'm going to ask you about this too, but the latest review of your book in Landfall, the reviewer kept talking about waiting for the polemic to come, and it doesn't. And, you know, I could have written this as an A5 flyer, right? And just spammed everyone. And I've done that before, and I probably will do it again. But yeah, so what is it about wanting to craft it as a book or a novel? There's something obviously there. And I mean, I would like to think that there has to be some enjoyment for us as creators. But yeah, that's an interesting question. I wonder how you feel about that.
Yeah, because I do think, I'm like a really massive fan of polemic. Like I think I was saying to you before, like there was a point where things were very bad politically in New Zealand. I know it's hard to imagine, but like, and just, I just thought to myself, the time for being, I don't know what the right word is, ambiguous is over. And like, if
I
wanted...
It was uncalled to be earnest for a long time.
It's so true. It's so true. And I just thought, if I want to talk about workers' rights, I need to talk about work. You know, like, there's a story that I wrote which is called 0 Hours or something, and it was at that point where I thought, I need to say what I'm going to say, you know. And I think fictions are really... I don't know what the right word is. It's not an overly, safe isn't the right word, but it isn't an overly comfortable bedmate for polemic. So yeah, I like that challenge. I really like that challenge. And I think what you're saying about enjoyment is important. Like I think I get very excited about these new movements and kind of, you know, there's activist spaces that are all about queer joy, or, you know, like, you know, just some of the work that Joan Fleming's doing with Extinction Revival. You know, like, let's dance, let's do this. And I just do think that there is some power in that as well. And this is the thing I just think, again, in your book, which is so great, is that when it does come to needing to state something clearly, it states it in this, like, just very clearly, very straightforward, but in this language that is still inviting somehow, like even though, like I think the lecture is the thing that, and I think probably polemic needs lecture, I didn't go to school for very long, but like, you know, like it's this invitation to the idea rather than this, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I've stopped using the word historian because sometimes within that parameter, you know, you're not meant to have a position, or you're meant to let the facts speak for themselves, as if facts aren't problematic and that we don't have biases and choose topics. Again, it's not to say we make things up, but yeah, the part of the reason why I write books like this is because I do think history should be challenging and potentially lead to social change if possible, or at least be a use to people, but still be, like you said, enjoyable and accessible, but without watering down the politics either, I think.
Because that's what I think is astounding about the book, is I was just saying to someone yesterday, you know, like, I've read a lot of... See, and I think I might misunderstand history, but there's this really interesting thing that happens with the book, as I was saying to someone, it's kind of my crack cocaine. It's like, it's about work, it's about prisons, it's about capitalism, it's about colonisation. These are all the things that I want to learn about New Zealand, but it's really helping me understand the history of a broader New Zealand, if you know what I mean. And like, they said, well, that's the best history books that have got a narrow... And I just wonder, I'm just thinking, like, it must be so important as a writer of a book like this to have an understanding of, you know, the nuts and bolts kind of history, as well as the specific, like, where it sits in context, I guess, is what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to that curiosity thing. Naturally, I'm curious, I'm keen to learn about the spaces I inhabit and the people who have kind of... growing up or made that space, so that leads to more research, and then if I can bring people along, that's great. But that really, doing this research has made me think a lot differently about the spaces that, as I said in the reading, really take for granted. There's so many examples in the book, Yeah, I don't even know how to begin to start listing them, but it's really changed how I view the environment. And as a labour historian, I often did think about the work that had gone into a building or a road or a street. And then when I was learning more about Te Ao Māori and hapū histories, I started to think about deeper levels. And then this book, it's interesting, it's kind of brought that all together through that kind of labour and the class and colonisation. Mm. And also one thing I wanted to do with this book was do a chapter on the Pacific as well.
Yeah.
So many Indigenous scholars have been kind of asking Pākehā historians to include the Pacific, not only because we are part of the Pacific, but there's an important role that the state has played in the Pacific as well. So that was a challenge for me, and actually that was the first chapter I wrote. Yeah, so the book does look at spaces both here in Aotearoa but also in New Zealand's empire in the Pacific too.
That was one of the most challenging chapters, you know, like this idea that, again, that New Zealand exceptionalism that we're, I don't know, oh, sorry, I don't want to be anti, but, you know, like we're the good guys and, you know, and like that chapter was really, I have heard bits and pieces of those stories, but to have them collected in one place I think is just so important. And I guess that's part of the thing I wonder, I always wonder this, I've just seen Paul over there as well, like these books then become part of future research as well, eh? Like, I mean, there's something about, in a very real way, these books become part of the discourse in a way. Am I over-egging that or is that something that happens?
I mean, I think that's the hope, right? When you put a book out into the world that, like, it's going to affect someone.
Yeah.
And some of the best feedback I have is just from everyday people who have just reached out through my website and sent an email. Like, that for me just is, you know, the pudding. Like, that's why you do it. But, yeah, I think because a lot of people come up to me and it's like, dude, it's hardcover, it's going to last for ages, you know, like that's not going to, you know, fade anytime soon. I never really thought about it that way, because, there's always nervousness when you put something out into the world and I just hope someone reads it, that's, you know, the first thing, but then to think, oh yeah, it might last or it might affect discourse, that would be amazing. And, I have to say the reception has been really good, I think, in terms of there is, I think, a willingness and a want, especially for Pākehā, to think deeper about the spaces that we're in and some of the storytelling around those spaces or silences.
And that's what I think is so, this is what I love, I don't know, I think history is kind of the coolest, don't tell anyone, but I really, because I was just thinking, sorry, Paul, I know you just came to sit quietly, but even the conversations that take place between these two books that have just come out, you know, so close together, you know, the idea of, you know, like the organisation and the community that was in the prisons and Paul's book, and then, you know, like I just think it's so, it's so interesting. And that's the thing I guess I was interested in as well, is this collaboration with archivists. And, you know, you talked about taking photos and, you know, it really does feel like this collaborative project. And I wonder, you know, that must be incredible having, you know, I think writing can be, I don't know, maybe that's a cliche, but it can be a bit lonely sometimes, but the archive work must be really quite exciting.
Yeah, I agree. I think the writing aspect can be quite a solo effort, but there's that classic story where a historian will come along like, I made this amazing discovery in the archives, and then behind the desk the librarian's like, oh yeah, we filed that about 10 years ago. Already knew about that. But, there are a lot of people doing good work, and doing research is a kind of collaborative effort, and you're always stepping on the backs of others who have done a lot of that mahi to facilitate your research as well. And then the flip side of it, as we mentioned already, there are gaps and silences in the archives and libraries as well, and, you know, arguably embedded in quite colonial structures too. So, But yeah, it helps that I have worked in those spaces to kind of know where to look. But yeah, really thankful that they exist.
Yeah. Because I was, I'm just wondering, when you were speaking, this is probably wrong because I don't understand how archives work, but I also wonder if interest in an area will build collection in that area. Do you know what I mean? If there's, I don't know, say a sudden outburst in, I'm also thinking about the new archive, the LGBTQI plus archive that started. I wonder, I shouldn't say that. It's just rearranging things.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if, is that the way collection policy works, or am I, yeah?
It depends. So somewhere like National Archives, Archives New Zealand, as the government, are kind of collecting most things the state creates, but they make decisions about what not to keep. And then institutions like the Alexander Turnbull, where I work, are definitely thinking about those gaps and the voices that have not been represented in the collections, and look to change policy or approach collections differently. I've heard it referenced a bit like a weather vane. You know, if you think about one way it's flowing that way for some time and then it shifts over this way, and you kind of don't want to do that too much because you're trying to establish a collection that some kind of future researcher... This is so problematic, eh? I could speak for ages, and maybe we shouldn't, but yeah. This is that thing, is sources and archives are not neutral, libraries are not neutral, museums are not neutral. There are decisions, human-based decisions, based on power and hierarchies around what's kept and what's collected and what's not. But some of the coolest work in archives and libraries that I'm seeing at the moment is where, rather than be like, we've got a gap, we want your stuff, we'll fill it, it's more like, you're making these cool things, how can we support you, how can we fund you as a community to keep creating that stuff and maintain and own it yourselves? That's coming through from queer, feminist, trans communities, South Asian migrant communities collecting that way. So there's a lot of exciting things happening, and we're not all just dusty cardigan wearing. Nothing wrong with cardigans.
No, I was going to say, I hope you can... No, thank you so much for that, because it really does make me feel extremely excited. It just makes me really excited. We're going to ask if there are any... I imagine there are a lot of questions, so we're going to ask if there are any questions in a minute, but I just want to ask you one question while I have you. I think this might be a terrible question. What do you think your book can tell us, or maybe it doesn't need to tell us, but what are your reflections on prisons today based on what you know about prisons from the past?
I think the historian in me wants to kind of qualify that question and be like, over time things change and we need to think about specifics over periods, and it's not always possible that this past will speak to this present. But then the anarchist in me is like, of course, like the state and capitalism is still here, nothing's really necessarily changed in terms of the coercive power that's happening. And while prisoners might not be doing the outdoor work that the people were doing in this period, there's still that rhetoric of improvement. So if you go on the Department of Corrections website, it talks about the forestry nursery work that prisoners are doing so that they are rehabilitated and ready for meaningful employment when they leave. And obviously we need to earn a living. Capitalism means we have to pay for the things we need to survive. So I don't want to be disrespectful of people getting meaningful skills. It just sucks that there's an imperative before they even get there that is punishing and separating people from meaningful life. And so I think what I've learned through this book is that while they may be out of sight, prisons' impact on so much of our day-to-day lives to this very day. Whether it's keeping us on course to make sure we just, you know, go through the day-to-day life things, whether it's that idea of the state as the law making violence, and also just, yeah, that kind of racialization that happens. And then, you know, I do have friends who work in the criminal justice system and support people through that system, and they're talking about, just like every other sector of society, the cuts that are happening. So the prisons are understaffed, they're under-resourced, and actually even if they wanted to get prisons outdoors, they can't. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing this warehousing happening, which is very indicative and similar to what's happening in the USA, which, you know, we know New Zealand has some of the highest incarceration rates in the world. I think Māori are the highest Indigenous people imprisoned on the globe. So, yeah, prisons are very much still a thing. I'm wary of kind of making grand claims that my book will say something about that, but I would like to think that readers, it's in their vision, and it makes the reader think a bit more about power in the past and the present.
Mm, yeah, and I think, you know, like, thinking about those cuts, you know, they make space for private investment, which I think is one of the things I really get frightened about. And I think, you know, this is one of the things, like, I just cannot recommend this book highly enough. And one of the things that I think, it makes it impossible to walk anywhere and not have this thing made real, which I think that I can spend a lot of my life kind of avoiding a little bit. So yeah, I think that alone is, you know, there's so much more to the book, but that alone is quite amazing. I wonder if anyone has a question. If you shout it out, I can... Oh, kia ora, Eta.
An audience member notes that they've read Jared's other book, Dead Letters, and just asked Jared if he's got any thoughts on how writing that history set him up to write this one, or perhaps how they speak to each other.
Thank you. Yeah, so Dead Letters is about people's mail that was censored during the First World War. So the archives, again, had the actual letters that were confiscated and never reached the people. So that book took a snapshot of those letters, and then I wove the backstory around it, and it meant I could really quite focus in on someone's life and their life story. This was very different. Like this is probably the biggest thing I've done, and I was a bit worried about that because a lot of my past research has, in a way, been biographical and thinking about someone's life in a bigger picture. So I really had to think about time and scale. So the book goes from 1814, when the first missionaries arrived here in Aotearoa. They brought convict Irish labourers with them to Hohe Mission Station in Rangihaua in the Bay of Islands. So again, that's a like exception story just smashed right there in paragraph one. There were convicts building the missionary station, and the first structures built at the Waitangi grounds were built by those same Irish convicts. Mm. Yeah, so I really had to think about scale and think about, we all make decisions about what we include and what we can't include and what we leave out. So this book is full of silences just as much as the archive, but you had to think about scope. But I think Dead Letters did set me up to think about featuring protagonists, and I think we all relate to stories of other humans and other people, and so in Blood and Dirt, in particular chapters like the Pacific chapter, I will follow someone through, both as a means to telling a story, but also just to make it, to humanise it as well. So yeah, I think Dead Letters set me up for that. And it also led to this book, because that was where I came across this idea of vagrancy and vagrants too. Yeah,
because that is one of the things that's huge in there, is that the imprisoned population was made up of people kind of in precarious labour, right? Like it was kind of sex workers, sailors. Yeah, like it was really interesting. I think there was another question over there. Oh, kia ora.
This person acknowledges the things that Jared said about history from below and writing against the grain, saying things now and the other political actions the work takes, and asks, how does one stay brave?
Thank you for your question.
Kia ora.
That's a really interesting one. And of course, being a Pākehā male, it's easier for me to do that, right? So let's acknowledge that first off. Someone else writing this book or standing up and saying the things that I say might not quite have the same reception, right? And it helps that I've got a wonderful publisher behind me and, you know, a reputable publisher. So I want to acknowledge that. The second thing is, 10 years ago, I was way more righteous than I am now. I would have been on, like, indie media. You know what I mean? So I think I've mellowed a little bit. But, yeah, I think it's important to just say and name those structures of power. So if I can do that with the kind of means and the skills that I have, then I want to do that. And I really like that idea that people can do their politics and struggle and make change wherever they are. Like, we need musicians, we need people throwing barricades up in the middle of the street, we need people making food in the kitchen and breastfeeding the children, and also, like, throwing stuff at cop cars. So, you know, I think there's space and worth in all of us, if we can, struggling where we are. So that kind of drives me. So if I can contribute in this way with the kind of skills I've developed, then that's kind of where a lot of my work happens.
Mm.
I hope that's not a cop-out from doing other work. But, yeah, I do think that everyone should be able to create and struggle and do what they need to do from where they are.
Thank you so much for that. That means heaps, you saying that. Yeah, because I think sometimes we do feel like that.
Yeah.
This is a question about the structures of justice. How do we deal with the fact we still have this unfair system which is damaging people all the time?
Yeah, that's such a massive question. And then thinking about the, you know, thinking about the start of...
Sure, they're not here for you.
Yeah, or thinking about the start of this talk and acknowledging, you know, you just have to look at the news at the moment and it does feel a bit crushing. I'm not sure I have the answer to that, but I think we have to be still hopeful. One thing I have to remember is that law is a human-made thing. So yes, there's this impersonal domination, but at the root of these issues are human-made social relations. And that gives me hope that, like, people can change and create different ways of relating to each other. So I hold on to that, but yeah, definitely, it's a massive thing, yeah.
Because I think that, oh, Kilda.
There was another question over here.
Oh, okay, well, we're here, then there. Is it okay?
Yeah, I think there was one over here.
Oh,
yeah.
Someone, sorry.
This is a question in relation to creative nonfiction. And the person asked if Jared had any advice on how to not be afraid to approach work that mixes research and facts with creative nonfiction.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think you can probably speak to this as well, writing fiction, right? Because whether the project is speculative non-fiction or creative non-fiction or even fiction, if you're immersing yourself in a time or a place or a world, you sort of want to know about that world. So my own advice is just thinking of context is really important. So I read a lot. I try and read what others have said about that time or place, sometimes visiting a place. So yeah, the section of the bibliography is way too long, but it's reflective of just trying to immerse myself in what others have said. And also acknowledging and knowing that, like, what I say about this is what I say about this, and others might have a different take and say it differently. And again, it's not to make stuff up, but it's to point to where you've got the info from. Like that. And I guess that's the reason we have footnotes, and that's the reason why you trace past scholarship, is then you've got a roadmap of where what you've written has come from. And so that would be my only advice. Adam Hochschild, who is a really amazing writer that I've talked about, he wrote about the abolition movement. And the example he gives was he needed to figure out, like, when this first meeting of abolitionists took place in this pub in Britain, what would it have been like? So he read a lot from the newspapers and figured out that there was a tannery next door, so it probably would have stank like piss.
Yeah.
Do you know, like, little details like that you only get through immersing yourself in a place. But do you ever?
Oh, no, I really like what you're saying. I friggin' love bibliographies. Bibliographies, and your indexer, Oh my goodness.
Indexes needed pay rise, eh?
Yeah, just like I love this. I'm not like just this idea of like, I don't know if I'm overstating this, but it feels like a net of relationship, eh? And like you say, I just think saying this is what I'm saying about it. I love the way you said that. I think it's just so true, yeah. And I think, yeah, just acknowledgements and, yeah, footnotes and, yeah, I just, yeah, I love it. Sorry, I'm blissing out on bibliographies now. But, yeah, that's wild. Yeah, I agree.
Someone asked what the word polemic meant.
A polemic? Yeah, I could Google it, but because I don't...
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact definition. So my first book, a reviewer in the press said it was a socialist polemic, and I kind of took that as doing something right. But I think it's the idea that, like, propaganda and ideology has taken over your practice and you're just pushing a line on someone. Yeah. And it's argumentative. But I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's often used, especially in history... If you don't like someone's history, you can say it's a polemic, and then suddenly their book's trash. And it happens.
So
and it's
same with fiction and poetry. Like,
yeah, I don't know if it's the same, but you know, think about critical race theory at the moment in the US. You just need, or even Howard Zinn, People's History of United States, that was just written off by right wingers as a polemic and as kind of. Yep. Cherry picked and yeah. Did you find a definition?
Oh, yours was better.
Someone from the audience read out a definition of the word polemic, and it was this: a speech or piece of writing expressing a strongly critical attitude on or controversial opinion about someone or something.
And when you read that definition, I'm thinking, God forbid. You know, like, it just that sounds like what I'd quite like to read. I don't know. That sounds great.
This is a question about how Jared took care of himself while he was writing from archives, especially archives that could be upsetting or triggering.
It's a really good point. I don't know if I've become, desensitized to that as an archivist when you do come across... And so Paul Diamond's in the audience, and let's shout out, because Paul helped with the book and has paved the way for a lot of amazing research. But he'll speak to this as well. You can be looking through the most blasé titled folder, and suddenly there's something very heavy in it, especially within Te Awamate. That's where I also want to acknowledge my partner Zoe, because, you know, there's always people you debrief with, aren't there? You know, you have your crew or your friends or your partner or... people that you need to kōrero with to kind of process that. But I think that's sometimes what drives you then, you know, drives me as well, to turn that around. And yeah, Marmari Stevens, when we had a talk about the launch, she was like, I got a sense of outrage from your book. I don't know if that's quite the right word, but definitely that passion to want to share this, because I feel outraged about it is there. But yeah, I don't know if there's an answer, but that care work's really important. Yeah. And totally, archives are starting to acknowledge the grief and emotion of both the content, but also the spaces where people do that research as well. So I think that's a good thing too.
This question asks how Jared's current work, Blood and Dirt, links with ideas of prison abolition.
Yeah. Well, that question of, you know, why we write books, I think I have to acknowledge that there is a growing abolitionist movement. And, you know, my background is in anarchist working class politics, and abolition of prisons just seemed like this weird kind of thing that the kind of, you know, we should be talking about the masses here and the industrial unionists, and it felt like a nice to have, but like no way is that ever going to happen. But the more I realised about enclosure and that barbed wire fence and how enclosure and caging people from prisons to schools to employment is so tied up, I realised that actually the abolition of prisons is the abolition of capitalism. But of course, there are always people, and unfortunately, harm does happen. But as Pip said, there's some great work being done, even in Aotearoa. So my friend Kim McBreen, who worked at Te Wānanga Ōraukawa, has created a creative inventions toolkit where anyone can go online and get some advice and connect to people of dealing with harm outside of state structures. So I'm hopeful that there are thinking and moves and connections and community being built to address those questions. And if the book contributes to that, then I'll just be so happy. But yeah, it's an ongoing talk, I think.
Childa, I think unfortunately. Oh, shall we? Yep. Let's go then. Yeah, let's do it.
This was a two-part question about labour and prisons. First of all, it was asking about the labour movement during the time that the book is set. And secondly, it was just a question or comment around home detention and how home detention is kind of making prison labour a little more invisible in our society.
Yeah, really quickly, it seems to me that in the 19th century, the labour movement was more worried that prisoners would take the labour of, you know, the honest, industrious worker from that person, and that's part of the scope of unions, was protect their members. So at that stage, it kind of led to some of the work gangs and actually prisoners being sent to Milford Sound and these obscure road camps because of that issue. My book stops in the early 1920s, but I think there is a study there to be done about the labour movement as it became more established in prisons. And yeah, the second question, I think the more that we can think about class and struggle and change as a wider phenomenon, but not blurring it all, is going to be a really important thing moving forward. Yeah, and there was another question. Sorry, that's not a very good answer.
The anarchist in me wants to keep going, but
maybe
let's go for the last question.
This person noted rightly that stories and histories are taonga and asked how Jared works with them in this way, how he respects them while he's doing the work.
For sure, yeah, that's really important, especially some of those more somber stories of Māori incarceration. You know, the Pakakohe people that were taken from Taranaki and put to work all around Wellington. That's not necessarily my story that I can tell in any depth and significance, but I think to not tell that story, especially for other Pākehā, would be, like, remiss of me. So you're right. And I actually think archives, at their very essence, is storytelling, whether it's oral or in paper. Archives are the kind of stories we tell about ourselves to make meaning and to remember. So yeah, I just try and honour them. I try and approach it with respect. Where I can, I try and reach out to people. So Dead Letters, I manage to connect with descendants. Obviously it's not always possible, but yeah, I think it just comes down to like an ethic and a moral approach. And yeah, just being aware of what you say and what you put out will have ramifications for people.
Yeah. Thanks, Jared. And thank you, everyone, for being so engaged and amazing. Jared will be at the back, and I know that even if you don't buy a book, Jared will answer your questions and have a chat with you. Is that all right? So, yeah, if you have questions, I'm sure we can carry on the conversation. I just need to say thank you for coming out to this event. Thank you so much, everybody, staff, support crew, Claire, Andrew, sound people, everybody. And yes, Unity Books are at the back, and they will have copies there. So yeah, thank you so much,
Jared. Thank you.